Hey, thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me, and to all of you for being here. I'm going to talk about quasi-neural modes pretty generally. So, an outline of my talk, basically the first half of my talk is the perfect introduction to Stephen's talk, and the second half of my talk was perfectly introduced by Stephen's talk. So, maybe if we'd interleaved our talks, this would be even more useful. So I'm going to start the talk by just discussing what is black hole ring down and what are quasi-neural modes. And then I'm going to focus on the really exciting development in the field of quasi-neural modes, which is, of course, we finally have a ring down to look at and some targets and goals to think about in terms of gravitational wave astrophysics. I really want to emphasize that the first half of this talk, I'll be reporting on work by others. I am not a member of the LIGO collaboration. But since this is a workshop, I figure it's okay to talk about the exciting developments in the field generally. Second half of the talk, I'll talk about work I was more involved in and work that was done over the years with many collaborators, especially Huan Yang here at Perimeter, who was involved in basically all of that work over the time. I'll be talking about the quasi-neural modes of very rapidly rotating black holes and why they're very interesting and exotic. How one might compute the quasi-neural modes of objects which are not quite Kerr black holes as described by GR, but maybe have been deformed by something, maybe an alternative to GR. And then a neat application of those techniques, actually, to parametric resonance and maybe something like gravitational turbulence of a rapidly spinning black hole, also known as that thing that Stephen kept mentioning I would talk about. So here we go. To set the stage, of course, in gravitational waves, a huge amount of effort has been done over the years to solve the problem of compact binary inspiral. So the inspiral of two compact objects is expected to be the main source of gravitational waves coming into gravitational wave detectors on Earth and in space. It's roughly divided into three parts. The very long part is the slow inspiral of the two objects under their emission of gravitational radiation. As they inspiral, the signal gets stronger because they begin to move around each other faster and faster as they get closer and closer. This can be tackled using post-Newtonian techniques, V over C expansion. Then there's a region where that V over C expansion basically breaks down. This is when the black holes get very close together and eventually merge, join into a final object. This can really only be treated with numerical methods, full numerical simulations of Einstein's equations. And then finally, the phase I'll be talking about a lot in this talk is what's called the ring down to the final state of the black hole. So that picture was developed by many years, over many, many years, by many, many people, and it was really amazing to have that chirp signal vindicated recently in this landmark detection by the LIGO-Virgo collaboration of a merger of two binary black holes far out in the universe. So by now you've all seen these slides many, many times, so I won't dwell on it too long, but you really see this beautiful chirping signal just as predicted by theory. The chirping signal is well fit by two black holes of approximately 30 solar masses, which merge together into a final black hole of about 60 solar masses. The spins on these holes were not very well measured, although they are consistent with being small in the sense of small component aligned with the angular momentum. But the mass of the spin of the final black hole was measured. This chi is the dimensionless spin. It ranges between 0 and 1, with 1 being the theoretical maximum we think black holes can spin before their horizon is stripped away and you can see the naked singularity inside. This event took place pretty far away with moderately large error bars, and you will probably have heard many times, characteristic of these sorts of events, it was incredibly luminous. It outshone the entire universe just in gravitational waves for a brief period of time. So there's an amazing amount of astrophysics and fundamental physics that one can do with this. Franz Pretorius and Nico Yunus are going to be talking about that in the next two talks today. The thing that was really exciting for me was this last little bit that you can sort of barely see. Sure enough, the signal peaks and falls, and you can actually see one or two cycles by eye of this decaying signal. And this is the final ring down of that final merged black hole. This is sort of been described with some caveats as the smoking gun signature that this final object was in fact a black hole, just as Einstein has predicted. And I'll be talking about this ring down. So what exactly is a black hole ring down for those who are not yet familiar? Basically, the idea of that final portion of ring down, the way you model it, is you take the final state, the final quiescent black hole, and you imagine that just after merger, what you've got is a strongly perturbed black hole. So then you do linearized perturbation theory about the final solution. And at merger, you imagine that that final black hole is strongly deformed, spinning, and needs to relax down. This deformation, basically, you can view as a broadband perturbation on the final state. Now, black holes themselves possess, intrinsically, a set of resonant modes. Okay, they just like a bell, they have their own set of resonances. These are decaying resonances, and hence we call them quasi-normal modes as opposed to normal modes. And you imagine that in the ring down, the black hole has broadband perturbations which excite some of these modes, and then these modes ring away for a little while. I've plotted here the fundamental 2-2 mode of a Schwarzschild black hole. You see you've got this characteristic ringing and decay. The decay is actually rather prompt, and then you've got actually additional overtones here, which you see decay much more rapidly. So I'm going to discuss sort of an intuition first about how these resonances arise and how to think about them, and then I'll get into the mathematics a little bit more. There's two really nice pictures to always have in your head when you're thinking about quasi-normal modes or processes happening in black hole perturbation theory in general, and that's sort of a picture of null rays. Imagine firing little laser beams around in the black hole spacetime, and a quantum mechanical scattering picture that you should be sort of familiar with way back in undergraduate quantum mechanics, doing simple scattering problems off of potentials. So in this null ray picture, if I imagine shining null rays into the spacetime, basically two things are going to happen. A lot of these null rays, they're just going to deflect around the black hole and its gravitational well. But of course, some of them are just going to fall in if they get too close to the black hole. In the scattering picture, what's happening here is you imagine there's an incident wave, and it's going to come in, and the space-time around the black hole can be represented here as sort of an effective potential barrier to these waves coming in. Some of them are going to be reflected right back out, and some of them are going to be transmitted through that potential. But because there's these two states, one where the null rays will pass right by the hole, one where they fall in, there's also this sweet spot right in between where I can shine the null ray and it will actually orbit forever just on a very unstable orbit. If I miss this very slightly, the rays will still orbit for a little while, but it'll be a transient orbit. They'll either fall in or escape the space-time. In the wave picture, what this null ray picture corresponds to is right here at the peak of the potential, if I tune my energy very carefully, I can put some energy right here on this, what's called the light ring, this null orbit, and the energy can leak out to infinity and down into the hole without actually having to shine in any incident waves. The mathematics for this is actually fairly simple conceptually and can be understood basically in the same way of the hydrogen atom in quantum mechanics. So I'll just focus on talking about the scalar wave equation in Schwarzschild first and do a few extensions from there. The scalar wave equation for Schwarzschild, we've got our wave operator in a curved spacetime. We've got a spherically symmetric spacetime, so we're going to do separation of variables, of course, into the spherical harmonics. That takes care of all the angular stuff. We're also going to expand in the frequency domain, and so everything boils down to solving for the radial wave function. You get a very simple radial wave equation, which looks exactly like the one-dimensional Schrodinger equation, with this effective potential. You can see there's sort of an effective GR here and here, and a centrifugal barrier here with some azimuth, with some angular quantum numbers L, just like in the hydrogen atom. Now, You can't just solve this equation without any more input. You also need to know the boundary conditions. If the boundary conditions were an incident wave, you could calculate the reflection and transmission. But in the particular case of quasi-neural modes, we demand that our boundary conditions be purely outgoing. Waves can only go down into the black hole or out into to infinity. And so in that case, this equation can only be solved at a discrete set of frequencies with a discrete set of decay rates. And these are the quasi-neural modes. That's the story for the scalar field. One of the amazing things and one of the super convenient things about this field is that the story is exactly the same, whatever you want to imagine is the field propagating in your space-time. If you want to think about electromagnetic fields or if you want to think about gravitational fields, you simply choose a preferred reference frame, a preferred set of vectors in the space-time. You contract all your tensor indices onto those, and with some hard work and turning some crank, you discover that basically, every field can be described as a spin-weighted scalar field, and the exact same story falls through. Equations very similar to this apply to all these scalar fields, and once you take some derivatives of them, you can recover your tensor fields. So whether you're talking about gravitational waves or electromagnetic waves, they all have this discrete set of quasi-neural modes. The last thing to note is that techniques for calculating these quasi-neural modes were developed a long time ago. It's actually fairly straightforward and standard to calculate them. So the challenge is not to get these modes. That was the story for Schwarzschild. What happens to this picture when the black hole rotates? Well, the change is fairly simple. It's basically a magnetic splitting. When we add rotation here, the orbits of light split according to their inclination with respect to the black hole. Those light rays which are more in the equatorial plane tend to orbit closer to the black hole. Those which are more inclined tend to orbit further away from the black hole. In the wave picture, again, everything holds, but now we have dependence on the azimuthal quantum number, which tells you essentially how inclined, in some sense, your waves are with respect to the spin axis. And so there's a sort of Zeeman splitting of these frequencies. Everything is the same in terms of being able to calculate everything in terms of scalar fields, boiling all down to a single radial wave equation. And actually, this fact is one of the great miracles. A priori, there's no reason why around a spinning black hole, the equations would completely separate into a one-dimensional radial equation, but they do. And that's actually still a bit mysterious as to quite why that happens. General thing to keep in mind as you increase the spin of the black hole from zero on upwards is that the faster the black hole spins, generically, the frequencies of the quasi-neural modes go up, and their decay rate goes down. So if you're just wondering what happens as the black hole's spinning, what happens to its ring down, this is the general takeaway. So the quasi-neural modes have received a lot of interest from the perspective of gravitational wave science because they basically provide you with a really unique and clean way of measuring the properties of the final object, right? They allow you, for instance, to measure the mass and spin of your final black hole solely from the resonant frequencies. So the mass is set by the overall scale of the frequencies, roughly 32 kilohertz for solar mass black holes and going down for heavier black holes. And the combination of the frequency and the decay rate, these would then tell you the spin. So as an example here, you can see we've got the frequencies and the quality factor of all kinds of different modes, the L equals 2, 3, 4. These are all split magnetically, right, like I said, by the spin of the black hole. And you can see that if you'd measured this 2, 2 mode here really well, then you could read off the mass and spin. You can also, by the way, see that black holes are terrible resonators. Their quality factor is like 2. Okay, they're really bad. Another thing you can immediately then think about is, okay, if I measured one mode really well, I could get the mass and the spin. If I measured two modes, then I can test GR, right? This spectrum is a unique prediction of GR, and so a lot of thought has gone into what happens if you could measure two modes. This turns out actually to be pretty hard, so I'm now going to report on one of the more recent studies of this idea of black hole spectroscopy. There's a whole history of this field, and this paper was written in the light of the LIGO's detection of gravitational waves. basically that L equals 2, M equals 2 quadrupolar mode, it dominates. It way dominates over all the other modes. Okay, for basically any in spiral, it's 10 to 100 times larger than the next mode in the ring down. What that means is that you need a really large signal to noise to measure this second mode. You might measure the first mode really well and get the mass and spin, but that does not mean that you're going to be able to do a test of GR. Generally speaking, these sorts of tests are very hard for ground-based detectors to do, but they're much more easy for space-based detectors or for more massive black holes. The simple reason being that roughly the signal-to-noise of the ring down scales is the mass of the system to the 3 halves power divided by the characteristic noise in your detector. Space-based detectors have worse noise as compared to ground-based detectors, but when you're starting to think about 10 to the 6 solar mass black holes as opposed to 100 solar mass black holes, you really went out here. And so what this plot is showing is for a series of upcoming and proposed ground-based detector designs, some of them very futuristic, in the context of some population synthesis models, these authors calculated how many events per year you could expect to measure a ring down. Just to measure one mode, that's SNR of about 8 for the ring down. You can see this is O1 of LIGO. Depending on how conservative your population synthesis model is, you might measure a few. Okay, we've measured one now. That may have been really lucky. Going on to full design LIGO up to even more futuristic designs like these are the Einstein telescope designs, you can see you might get many, many ring down measurements. But this second set of curves are those ring down measurements where you could actually extract the second mode. Okay, and you see this is a much more dismal prospect for ground-based detectors. Even you need to go all the way to very futuristic ideas like the Einstein telescope to imagine that you even start to detect more than one or two of these black holes with very loud SNR in which you could actually do a test of GR. Okay, so given that really sort of depressing perspective now, let's turn to thinking about the ring down. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
But if you have a bunch of them, even the
well, we'll get to that, right? So, yeah, this is per event, right? So now you're going to think, okay, well, let's be clever here. We're going to do more than just look at them event by event. So first, I'll talk about the ring down that was seen and what could be measured from it, and then I'll talk about how to mitigate this problem. As Luis pointed out, you can leverage statistics. Okay, so. Huge moment, ring down of GW150914. It's the very first detection of a black hole ring down. And the take-home message is the frequency and decay rate of that ring down was basically completely consistent with the GR prediction for this dominant mode, the L equals 2, M equals 2 quadrupolar mode with characteristic frequency. You see 32 divided by 60 gives you around 200 as expected. This plot shows how that analysis was done. Remember, you get the full signal in the detector, and you have to decide, how do I extract these ring down frequencies? Well, you start at some time t. This one is marked, for instance, this one is marked here. This is basically where they think merger is sort of going to be defined. That's a very fuzzy concept. But you start at some time t here, like 5 milliseconds after merger. And what you do then is you would fit forward for all the rest of the signal, and you try to see how well you can extract that signal. You have two competing problems. Obviously, if you just want the dominant mode, you want to wait as long as possible so that all of the other modes ringing around in here have gone away. But then you get a very small SNR. So if I wait seven milliseconds, I am centered around the correct frequency, but with a really huge posterior. Meanwhile, you could go closer and closer to merger, but now you have a systematic error that's going to build up. That's because you're not really just measuring one mode, you're measuring a whole family of modes. And so if you just do 1 millisecond after merger, you see your posteriors are small, but just completely biased, centered around the wrong thing. This black curve is the predicted frequency for the full analysis. If you look at the entire signal, everything we know about GR and numerical simulations, you would anticipate, based on the final mass and spin that are measured, that this is the range of frequencies. And you can see that around 5 milliseconds, you sort of hit the sweet spot. You extract a consistent posterior, but it's pretty wide. You can see that this is very challenging, and there's a lot more work to be done. this question of when the ring down starts is a fundamental question people are still struggling with. And even though ring downs have been studied for many, many years, it's not fully clear what the optimal analysis is yet for extracting these kinds of modes. You can see it's hard enough to measure this one, so it's kind of impossible to imagine measuring the second mode. But you'd still like to do a ring down consistency test of GR. So what do you do? Well, this is sort of what Luis was getting at. You try to formulate an analysis which will work even for weak signals, but which you can then apply to many, many signals. So what was done for GW1509, you only measured one mode, but you can do a consistency test if you sort of do something a little kludgy, but it's still not a bad idea. You basically want to test the consistency of the overall signal. You split it at the merger into an early part, the in-spiral, and a post-in-spiral part, which includes both the merger and the ring down. So it contains a lot of nonlinear physics. You take everything you know about the early in-spiral, and you take everything you know from fits to simulations and your knowledge about ring down, and you also will look at the post-merger process. And what you do here is you're going to extract the predicted final spin and final mass. So for this in-spiral part, you do your best to measure the initial masses and spins of the black holes that are the components of this binary. And then you use tables that people have done by numerical fits that tell you, given that input, this is the final spin and mass of the black hole. So that's your expected final spin and final mass. And then, based on the actual nonlinear physics, where maybe something exciting is happening if GR is wrong, you try to extract the final mass and final spin from the merger ring down, and you see if they're consistent. And here's the result of that analysis. The in-spiral posteriors are plotted here in terms of mass and spin. The post-in-spirals here, this is for the full analysis. This is the value that was reported by LIGO. You can see that while the centers are shifted from each other, there is overlap. So right now, the ring down of GW1509, this consistency test is completely consistent with GR, but you can see that it's maybe not quite as satisfying as you'd like.
Is that 68%?
Say again? Oh, what are these posteriors? Kip, do you know?
95.
Yeah, I would have guessed that. 95, yeah. Thanks, Kip. Yeah, so there's at least one LIGO person in the room, so please, that person, tell me if I say stupid things. Don't. 90%, all right, great, yeah. So, of course, this or more.
So, I think you did a great job explaining this, but I think we need to be a little careful about how we interpret the results of the test of VR. It would be very strange for the spiral to be exactly as predicted by VR with two black holes, and then all of a sudden when they merge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'll play devil's advocate and I'll say, imagine that these were some kind of weird neutron stars. It may be that the tidal effects are pretty weak in this system until very close to merger, but the final object could be expected to have an incredibly different ring down, as Franz will probably discuss in the next talk. And in that case, this consistency test could fail miserably. Right? So Nico's completely right. This is not necessarily an ideal consistency test, but it is a consistency test which focuses on this idea of testing via ring down your assumptions about GR. But Nico's totally right. If GR were violated, it could well be violated consistently all through here. The system could sort of look like GR from the perspective of this test, but give you completely biased mass and spin and other parameters, right? So take everything with caveats, right? This is another region where better tests can be developed still. Now, the nice thing about these kind of tests, though, is that they allow you to leverage statistics. So the rate estimates that were published by LIGO following this event, just based on GW1509-14 and the other like 2 sigma, 2, 3 sigma trigger, was that you could expect 2 to 400, conservatively, mergers per gigaparsec per year, which is sort of the space-time volume probe by advanced LIGO at design sensitivity. So you might expect a lot of these things. So this group of people, a rather large group of people all involved with LIGO, shortly before actually the event, put out this paper, which points out that if they take 100 events, which basically look like 1509-14, so all of them SNR 25, After about 100 of these, you can basically stack these all together in a Bayesian likelihood analysis and do this test and figure out this delta chi f is basically the difference in the final measured spin from the second half versus the final spin expected from the first half, same for the mass. And you can see that initially this delta is huge. You get like, what, 50% maybe test of GR, however you want to think about that. But after multiple events, these begin to stack together and narrow down. And after about 100 events or so, you can see that you can achieve maybe a percent level test of GR in this particular context of this consistency test. So this is sort of where the field is going to be going, right? We may not get a lot of, I mean, we were really lucky to have such a loud signal in the first place, but it's still not loud enough in some sense to be perfect tests of GR. But you're going to want to develop statistical methods to leverage what we hope will be many, many such events coming to us over the next 5-10 years. How am I doing on time, Luis? I want to make sure I talk about the thing Steven said I would talk about. 15 more minutes. I'll skip this in the interest of time. Okay, on to rapidly rotating black holes. Ask me about space-based detectors and ring down afterward if you're interested. So a lot of the work I've done in the past was focusing on very extremely rotating black holes. And these are interesting theoretically and possibly observationally. Theoretically, they're interesting because at very high spins, a lot changes in the space-time. The space-time actually simplifies enormously. You get a new approximation, basically, if the spin over the mass caps out at 1, then you get a small parameter of 1 minus this thing that's almost 1. This new small parameter actually allows you to do a lot more analytic theory than you could do otherwise. There's some connections in this Kerr-CFT duality to sort of these gravity field theory dualities, which becomes available at very high spins. And there's also a lot of interesting questions about cosmic censorship. If a black hole's spinning really fast already, can I spin it over this limit and reveal the naked singularity? There's been some investigation of horizon instabilities by mathematicians and recently now by some people here. As far as astrophysics is concerned, it may be that supermassive black holes, if they do a lot of their growth by accretion, these too can be spun up to actually a fairly extreme level. And so studying these black holes may be interesting from an astrophysical perspective. So let's quickly go through how the quasi-neural mode picture changes when spin gets very large, because it's really quite interesting. So from this dual wave and null ray picture, remember, we can focus on the light ring. As you crank the spin up, and we focus for now on equatorial orbits, that light ring progressively gets closer and closer to the horizon as the spin goes up, until finally it sort of locks onto the horizon. Once it's locked onto the horizon, everything on this light ring has to co-rotate at the horizon speed. So everything is sort of at one frequency. The other thing from the wave picture we see is that the decay rate of these modes really depends on the curvature of these potentials. As I focus on an equatorial orbit and crank up the spin, it turns out this curvature actually gets smaller and smaller and smaller until you reach an inflection point in the extreme limit, and the decay rate goes to zero. When we move away from equatorial modes, remember there's this mode splitting, what you find is that for orbits which are inclined something less than 42 degrees, they all latch onto the horizon, they all co-rotate to the horizon, and they all have their decay rates fall to zero. Meanwhile, those modes which are more inclined, they tend to stay far away, and they tend to continue to have some moderate decay rate. You can see this is plotting, in some sense, the inclination of all the different kinds of quasi-neural modes you could have, and a whole family of them come down and go to zero decay rate in the extreme limit. So to say that again, what you find from that null ray WKB treatment is this interesting thing where the frequency goes to something times the horizon frequency. The decay rate is suppressed by that small parameter epsilon, meaning that the decay rate gets really long. The decay time scale, sorry, gets really long. The decay rate gets very short. And actually, in this approximation scheme, using sort of a near and far horizon matching scheme, you can actually show this is analytically true for all kinds of modes, not just modes which are well approximated by null rays. So this is a generic fact of rapidly rotating black holes. They have this very characteristic spectrum. The spectrum is very interesting. A lot of neat phenomenology arises once you have this sort of thing. What you basically have is you have a black hole, which you can think about again as a whole set of modes, and all these modes basically have the same frequency as each other. So one thing that happens right away is that when I excite these modes, I tend not to just excite one of the many overtones. Instead, I excite many of the overtones all at once. And instead of just having a single mode which shrinks down exponentially, you actually excite a huge family of modes which have a qualitatively different decay rate for a period of time, which gets longer and longer and longer the more rapidly the black hole spins. So here we have a numerical simulation where we evolved a Gaussian wave packet around rapidly rotating black holes. Remember, epsilon is this 1 minus the spin parameter. You get basically on the semi-log plot exponential decay for a black hole which is spinning at like 0.99. But as we crank up the spin, you no longer get this exponential decay, but you get this very interesting characteristic power law decay for a fairly large period of time. So this is sort of a unique, interesting signature of the ring down of these black holes, and it comes out of the fact that instead of exciting one mode at a time, you shake up the whole system at once, because they're all basically the same frequencies. Another interesting thing that happens, and this is where Stephen's talk is an excellent introduction to the second part of my talk, is that when you've got a bunch of frequencies which are either commensurate with each other, so they're separated by integers, or they're all approximately the same as each other, modulo the small perturbation here, which is the case in the rapidly spinning holes, you can start thinking about these coupled oscillator systems and ask yourself, oh, cool, could there be resonances? Could we have nonlinear mode coupling? Remember, I've been talking about linear black hole perturbation theory, but the Einstein equations are nonlinear. And so if we think about this as a system of oscillators, the next to leading order part of the equations will induce nonlinear mode coupling, and these modes will begin to talk to each other. So in collaboration with people here at Perimeter who are working on this fluid gravity duality, thinking about these mode coupling problems, Huan Yang sort of realized that parametric resonance was an especially promising channel for these kinds of effects to have sort of a big effect on the ring down of these objects. And so with Luis Lehner, we went and studied this idea that you could actually have a mode prime forcing another set of modes parametrically through these sort of resonances. So that's a hard problem to tackle. So how did we go about doing it? Well, first of all, you realize right away that second order GR is hard, right? I mean, first order GR can sometimes be, so just working with black holes can sometimes be hard. Working on black hole perturbation theory can sometimes be hard. You really don't want to go all the way to second order. Things get really nasty really fast. So we took a strategy from the mathematicians, which is sort of the poor physicist linearization, they call it. If you're interested in studying the linearization of Einstein's equations, you don't start right away with this problem. You solve the scalar field equation, like I did before. Well, we can solve the scalar field equation, so let's do the poor physicist non-linearization. We're going to focus on solving the scalar field equation, but we're going to solve it on a background which has been perturbed. So we're going to have a black hole plus a first order perturbation, and we're just going to see how a test scalar field evolves in this oscillating ringing space-time. And we're going to want to see if this scalar field basically can experience a parametric driving from this perturbation. What we expect to see is the zeroth order scalar wave equation plus some additional operator coming from the perturbation. We want to see if this can drive the resonance, but even that's too hard to do. We need to develop new tools to study this problem, and that's where I get just a couple slides on what I'm calling quasi-neural modes beyond Kerr. So this is a general problem. Okay, so let's take a step back and let's think about a general problem. Say I'm interested in the quasi-neural modes of a space-time which is not Kerr, but it's slightly different than Kerr for whatever reason. So I'm going to say the metric is the Kerr metric plus some small parameter eta times whatever that perturbation is. Well, we already can imagine what we think is going to happen to the frequency spectrum. We expect all the frequencies to shift by some delta omega, which is controlled by that small parameter. The wave equations for all of those spin-weighted scalar fields I mentioned, we can see how they're going to change. Well, this change to the space-time means that the wave operator picks up some perturbation. We're going to, again, want to expand those scalar fields in the frequency domain and in angular harmonics, only this time they're going to be expanded with perturbed frequencies. And so we can see that the overall effect of working in this space-time is going to be to have the zeroth order operator plus the way that operator deforms, plus that this is the change to the modes themselves, plus the way the operator deforms due to the change in the space-time. And so this is an equation we'd now like to solve. This equation should actually look pretty familiar to you. Like I said before, all of the math here is basically just undergraduate quantum mechanics, and solving this problem is no exception. In undergraduate quantum mechanics, you learned how to do time-independent perturbation theory. You perturb the Hamiltonian by a small amount, the spectrum is perturbed by a small amount, and you can go ahead and solve this problem by left multiplying by the background states, dividing through by your normalization, and you can solve very simply for the perturbation to the spectrum. The exact same thing happens, that's a problem with bullets, to this equation, where you're interested now in solving for the shift in the modes. So once you've done that, you see that what you need to do is you need to find some inner product. This is a technical point I can talk to people about afterwards. This is actually not obvious how to do right away in a black hole for quasi-normal modes. But if you can define a finite inner product on your modes, then using this inner product, just like in quantum mechanics, I can take the product of my perturbation to the operator, divide it by the product of the susceptibility, if you will, to the shifts in the frequencies, and this will give you the shift in the frequencies. Yeah? No. You don't, this, so if you actually go through these steps, you'll discover that in order to get this far, you don't need a complete basis and you don't need a normalized basis, you just need a finite inner product that's self-adjoint on the left, it turns out. The same is true here. So you can't do the next step, you can't compute the perturbations to the basis if you don't have a complete basis without some thinking. So this is nice. This is sort of the, you have just enough stuff in a black hole space-time to calculate the shift to the spectrum. Any other questions about this? Okay. So again, our interest was in an analogy to a parametric oscillator, so I'll just go really quickly. You may recall the idea of a parametric resonance is that you are going to be forcing the oscillator, the usual oscillator equation with some decay, with some damping. The forcing term here, though, doesn't appear on the right-hand side. It's a forcing which oscillates the frequency. This is like if you have a stand-up swing and you pump it by raising and lowering your center of mass. It turns out if the forcing function is oscillatory with a frequency which is twice the resonant frequency of the swing itself, you excite the oscillator into motion. Okay, and in the limit of weak forcing and weak damping, the growth is controlled by this factor alpha, which is some competition between how far you are away from that perfect resonance here and how hard you force it. So to come back to our idea in rapidly spinning black hole space-time, our toy model, again, is to take a rapidly spinning black hole with a single mode active. This is these modes that decay very slowly at a frequency which is proportional to the horizon frequency. And we're going to try to evolve a test scalar field in this using our new knowledge about how to calculate how the quasi-normal modes of this kind of field are shifted when this operator is deformed in this way. If you go through the analysis, a slight generalization of what I just presented two slides ago, you find that the instability can occur. The fact that the background is time-dependent but at a particular frequency is what enforces that matching between the time frequencies, and also you find that there's a spatial harmonic matching. So you can't just pump any mode this way. It has to be a mode which is parametrically driven at half the driving frequency. So just like in the parametric resonator, you have some damping of the oscillator, which is that slow decay controlled by the high spin. You have some forcing term, which is how strong we make this background mode. You drive modes which are half the frequency of the driving mode, and they also have to have half the azimuthal magnetic quantum wave number. You find overall that the mode does grow, but it's transient. Okay, you have a decay, which is growing in time, which is competing with a growth factor, but since the background forcing is decaying in time, this growth can't go on forever. Eventually it tails off. So this is the really hard part here is to calculate these factors which control how fast this growth rate goes. This is where all the technical details sit. I can talk about that if anyone's interested. But instead, let's just look at the parametric instability in action, right? So this is, again, a semi-log plot. Up top is my driving mode in the background. Everything is normalized to its amplitude, so it decays in time. We seed a whole bunch of scalar field modes. This is the 2-2 mode. All of the scalar field modes have to be some L, and M has to equal 1, because M has to be half the driving mode. But it turns out that the L equals 2, M equals 2 mode can drive basically any other polar quantum number, any other L. But it drives them all with different strengths. So you see that you seed all these modes at about 10%, and sure enough, they all grow up rapidly. Eventually, this becomes too weak to drive further growth, and then they decay away. In pictures, this is what the 2-2 mode in the background looks like. This is the black hole with all of its seed modes on it. And over time, you develop progressively more complicated angular structure in latitude. And it turns out that over time, you would develop less and less angular structure in longitude. So this is now where Stephen's talk is especially useful. There's a lot of, what I've talked about is this effect in terms of a parametric instability. But there's a lot of interesting connections between this parametric instability and this fluid gravity duality idea if you stop and you think about the properties of this parametric resonance and the properties that you see in turbulence on these ADS fluid dual spacetimes. Right? So Stephen mentioned that turbulence has been previously seen in ADS black holes. This is that atoms at all group, you seed some shear type modes on a black brain spacetime, and you wait a really long time and evolve it, and sure enough, those modes quickly become very turbulent with a lot of eddies. What's being plotted here, by the way, is the determinant of the metric at the black brain horizon. So this is some geometric quantity, not some fluid quantity. This really is a full gravitational spacetime in ADS. And over time, these eddies combine together and sort of have an inverse cascade to larger scales, just like Stephen described. So the CFT dual to this picture is a 2 plus 1D long wavelength fluid approximation, as Stephen said. And 2 plus 1-dimensional fluids, one characteristic of their turbulence is an inverse cascade towards larger and larger scales. So what is the analogy here? Well, in this Kerr instability case, it's pure gravity. We don't have an ADS boundary at all. What's performing the trapping role here is not some faraway reflecting boundary of the spacetime. It's the actual centrifugal barrier, if you will, of the near horizon region. The spin there is so fast that it tends to trap everything in a really tiny layer right at the horizon. Just like in the turbulence case, we get a mode cascade. And what's interesting also is that we get a kind of inverse cascade, as I'll describe. So some other connections between our instability and turbulence, which leads us to say that our instability is sort of a turbulent instability, is that there's a characteristic threshold. The strength of the perturbation has to be larger than some competition between it and the decay rate, which looks exactly like the condition in fluids. Okay, so in a fluid, you're turbulent if your Reynolds number, which is the ratio of the velocity to some length scale times the viscosity of your fluid, has to be greater than some critical number. So in Stephen's case, right, by changing the temperature of the black hole, you controlled this parameter. The dual picture tells you that you, in the ADS fluid analogy, that the fluid velocity is in direct correspondence with H, and that the viscosity here is in direct correspondence with the decay rate of the quasineural modes. Okay, so what this means is that we arrive at a condition for growth which looks exactly like the Reynolds number condition in the ADS fluid picture. Now, the other detail is this inverse cascade. It's not a complete inverse cascade. It's an inverse cascade only in frequency and in this azimuthal degree of freedom, so around the black hole symmetry axis. You drive modes which have half the temporal frequency and half the spatial frequency, but only in that favored direction. So it's not a complete inverse cascade. You get both inverse and direct. So all of these things together have all the hallmarks of the transient turbulence that Stephen was talking about in his talk that Stephen and his collaborators have investigated in terms of the conformal fluids and that Adams and his group investigated in terms of a pure black brain spacetime. Yeah?
So
Yeah, sorry, I'll go back and emphasize and say it again. So we're solving this equation here, which is we're going to have the scalar field propagating on the background, which includes a quasi-neural mode. And using a generalization of the eigenvalue analysis I mentioned earlier, you basically are going to solve this equation in a perturbation series. So you have to assume that phi has some Fourier expansion in terms of azimuthal frequencies and time frequencies in order to eliminate the time and azimuth dependence. That's the resonance condition, that your frequency has to be a certain thing, your azimuthal has to be a certain thing. And then finally, you can calculate this growth rate by taking the inner product with your background mode. Yeah, this is the resonance condition. In order to actually understand the strength, whether or not growth occurs at all, the input is the strength of your mode and the detuning, but the geometry comes down to calculating these inner products between the perturbations of your operators and the forcing of the gravitational field. Yeah. I went through this kind of fast because I figured I was short on time. Do you have any other questions about these aspects of the problem? Anyone? Okay. Oh, is there really? Oh, you're right. Sorry. Thank you. No one has caught that in a few talks. Yes, Luis is completely correct. M here is the frequency space mode number, so it's like 1/L. So this L has to appear in the numerator. This has to be dimensionless. Thank you. Excellent point. Any other? Okay, so that was one application of this quasi-neural modes beyond Kerr. I don't have time to talk about it, but you can do other things. We also use them to calculate the quasi-neural mode in a weakly charged rotating black hole space time at arbitrary spin. This turns out to be a really hard problem because when you shake up the space time around a black hole which has an electromagnetic field, the static electromagnetic field also gets perturbed, and there's a complete coupling between the gravitational and electromagnetic degrees of freedom. This can be solved, it turns out, in Schwarzschild because you rely on the symmetries to help you out, but in Kerr, where you don't have spherical symmetry, this was a completely open problem. We worked on it, some people worked on it in the small spin limit, we worked on it in the small charge limit, and recently, in a slide that I actually put as my backup slide, a group of people actually solved it fully numerically for the first time. So this is now becoming a solved problem, but it highlights a nice way in which a space-time which is not quite Kerr, but has been perturbed in some general manner, can be solved using this eigenvalue perturbation formalism. So I will conclude and hopefully leave time for plenty more questions about either the first or the second half of my talk. And we'll conclude with an outlook on ringdowns and gravitational wave astronomy. So it's a really exciting time. We finally have a ringdown. Okay, this was not expected to happen for many more years. Okay, because if the black holes are less massive than the ones that were seen, you don't actually get a very sensitive measurement of the ringdown. Again, the rate estimates just based on the two. Sort of the detection and the trigger that was released by LIGO earlier this year gives you a pretty high rate of binary black hole mergers like GW150914. And so you want to develop ways to use statistics and leverage statistical power to improve these ring down tests of GR to something that can take advantage of this large number of mergers. From the second half of my talk, the outlook is the eigenvalue perturbation method can actually give you a tailored prediction, given your favorite perturbation of the black hole, for what its quasi-neural mode spectrum might look like, and allow you to maybe do more specific tests of GR. And also, this perturbation method can be applied to other systems. For instance, Huan, Yang, and Fan Zhang applied it to force-free electrodynamics around a spinning black hole. So there's possibly other applications of this eigenvalue perturbation towards open systems, like quasi-neural mode systems. So I'll stop there and thank you for your attention.
Questions?
So since the near extremal limit of
Kerr is gives you an ADS region near the horizon.
Yeah.
Do you suspect that the fact that I mean, you had some comment that it's there's no boundary in ADS, but you basically get a region of space that has all of it as close to the boundary as you want as you get closer and closer to extremality.
Right.
So, in some sense, ADS and having these commensurate frequencies are like the same thing.
I don't know about the commensurate frequencies. The question might be, I guess, does the fact that there's an ADS connection mean that you have very slowly decaying modes available that can be trapped, right? And so the connection between our picture and this Kerr CFT duality has not been fully fleshed out. So for those not familiar with it, very extremal or nearly extremal Kerr, if you take a region right close to the horizon and blow it up, that can be mapped onto a spacetime which is not ADS, but is ADS in two dimensions cross S2 in the angular dimensions. And a lot of work's been done there on that connection to conformal field theory, because that spacetime now has some new conformal symmetries. One tricky thing is the boundary conditions. In regular ADS spacetime, you know precisely what to do with the boundary conditions. But in a spacetime where you have a further asymptotically flat spacetime outside of this neck region around the black hole, the boundary conditions are a little bit different. So there are some complications in mapping these things together directly, but there's a lot of room for further work, and I hope people that are more of an expert in the Kerr CFT duality will look into those connections more, and I think people are doing that.
I mean, another interesting connection is that it's not really S2, it's a warped S2,
yeah.
and there's a azimuthal dependence in the metrics, mm-hmm. So that maybe has something to do with the difference in the modes around the equator and larger than 42 degrees.
Yeah, it's independent, obviously, of the azimuth, but it cares about the polar angle, is what you're saying. Yeah. There absolutely has to be something which breaks the spherical symmetry. It's not a sphere. It's got this dependence. So what would be really interesting is to find out if in that Kerr CFT or some fluid limit of Kerr CFT, you can also show turbulence, provided maybe you fix some boundary conditions which are convenient. Yeah.
So I was wondering if you have thought about the possibility of this parametric resonance having an analog with the super radiant instability. So there you have this bouncing of a scalar field back and forth, the centrifugal barrier, yeah, of a Kerr black hole. There's no scalar field here, but seems similar.
Yeah, so they are similar, right? Both rely on trapping. These quasi-neural modes are not in the super radiant regime. The epsilon perturbation pushes them to the other side of the, so they don't rob energy from the black hole. Perhaps one could engineer systems where they do. The other thing is that what would be perhaps interesting is, so in these black hole bombs, you have modes which are super radiant but are trapped. And so the super radiant modes, every time they scatter off the black hole, they draw more and more angular momentum off of the black hole and energy off the black hole, and you have a runaway instability. People are starting to figure out where that settles down to. What would be really interesting is to see if that instability itself has some kind of turbulent properties, especially in the case where you have a very rapid spin on the black hole in the case of the black hole bomb. So that is work that I don't know of anyone doing yet, but this is a very active field of study, and hopefully people will study. Doing this investigation around rapidly spinning black holes is quite hard, especially if you want to think about simulations, because everything is happening on a very thin layer near the horizon, so you really need to have an incredible resolution or adaptive mesh kind of scheme around the black hole in order to do anything particularly useful in that sense. So I think it's open.
Okay, let us thank Aaron again.